Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. As we gear up for award season, there's no better time to join us. By becoming a Vanity Fair subscriber, you'll gain exclusive access to our in-depth coverage of film, television, and the best of Hollywood. And that's just the beginning. Vanity Fair takes you inside the worlds of entertainment, culture, politics, and scandal, bringing you iconic images, era-defining stories, and much more. Get 15% off a year of digital access to Vanity Fair by visiting vanityfair.com and using promo code POD15 at checkout. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a full year of insights and exclusive digital access. Subscribe now.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair and Panoply. I am Katie Rich, the deputy editor of VanityFair.com, and I'm here in the same room as our digital director, Mike Hogan.
Hi.
Our senior writer, Joanna Robinson.
Hi, Katie.
And our film critic, Richard Lawson.
Hello, we're all here.
What a day, guys.
Yeah, we're all a little hungover.
I thought we weren't going to talk.
Sorry, I just blew up our spot.
We're all incredibly bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and very in tune with award season.
The reason
usual.
I sound terrible has nothing to do with alcohol.
Yeah, well, last week we mentioned that you were going to talk about your Marvel cover story, which came out, and you couldn't literally had no voice to talk about it.
Literally could not talk. And this is the best I've sounded in a long time, so deal with it.
You sound fantastic. Mm. So we will talk later about the Marvel cover story, but there are a ton of awards things that are going on this week. And as we record this about 10 minutes ago, the Critics' Choice Awards nominations came out, which I think are maybe an interesting place to start because they kind of summarize like what's been going on for the last week. We've had a good handful. And it's only nominations, so we don't have any winners. It's not like a new critical favorite. But you've got nominations for The Big Sick, Call Me By Your Name, Darkest Hour, Dunkirk, The Florida Project, Get Out, Lady Bird, The Post, The Shape of Water, and Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. Which, I don't know, like, Richard, to me, that feels like a pretty good summary of, like, what we are still talking about. Like, that's a pretty good roundup.
No, I think so. I think that Three Billboards is having a little bit of it was like a real front runner just a few weeks ago, mm-hmm. and has sort of taken a hit as people kind of reassess it, or critics who kind of waited or have weighed in and negatively.
Yeah.
But I think it's still hanging on. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so The Shape of Water got the most nominations from mm-hmm. the awards, but I think, as with the Oscars, I think that speaks a lot to the technical aspects of it. The Critics' Choice Award nominations do production design and editing and costume design and all of these things where something really technically challenging like Shape of Water would pop up in there.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think also, Joanna, we were talking to some of our West Coast colleagues last night at our little holiday party, and an interesting theory emerged that you had about The Shape of Water and where it's kind of landing in the season.
Well, it over the weekend, the LA Film Critics released their winners, and Shape of Water just sort of really surged in that group. And yeah, we were talking to some of our LA colleagues, and they had heard from Academy voters in LA. Everyone in LA seems really high on Shape of Water and doesn't seem to be all that interested in The Post, whereas people in New York were like gaga for The Post and don't really seem to care about Shape of Water. So I could not tell you. Well, like, I understand The Post thing. We were talking about this a little bit last night, Richard, that The Post is a very like East Coast, old world media sort of story. And it makes sense that LA is like not as enamored of it as New York might be. But why Shape of Water is hitting with LA so hard? I don't know if like Guillermo has a lot of stock in the town, or I don't know. What
I think
it is.
People in LA are really used to sleeping with monsters. So
nailed it.
I mean, the Shape of Water. The film is set literally above an old movie house. There's like a scene where they transform themselves into like a Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers musical. Like if the theory goes that Hollywood is obsessed with movies about movies, I feel like that's where Shape of Water.
It's the
really
La La
goes.
Land. I haven't
seen it yet, and I've been avoiding like reading about it because I kind of wanted to be delighted and surprised. So thank you for ruining that for me. No, but I didn't know that aspect. That makes so much sense. If it's quasi a movie about making movies and in a stretching way, then that makes sense why LA would be enamored with it, right?
Yeah, and people in the entertainment business kind of hate the press. You know what I mean? Like, they kind of like the press. Yes, we have to like stand up with them shoulder to shoulder against like, you know, evil Republicans or whatever.
Yeah.
Or Trump, I guess. But the press is such a pain in the neck to you know, actual entertainers. So I think, like, there's probably a limit to how, like, gung-ho they want to get about a story glorifying. Basically, each of us just wants to glorify ourselves and not the other. Right. That's all.
New York, like, critics are like, this is about the press, this is about us. And then the LA Academy voters are like, this is about movies and sleeping with monsters. This is about us. Two things I want to say about the Post. First of all, I wanted to correct the record. Mike asked me 2 weeks ago when I was on, I was like, oh, we were so blah on the Post trailer. And Mike was like, really? I went back and listened. Mike was right. I was wrong. But I just wanted to say that to his face. But it's also interesting because we just felt like, oh, well, this is it. Here comes the Post and it's over. And now we're back again in, like, questionable territory.
Because each kind of set of awards that comes out, there's been a lot of Call Me By Your Name, mm-hmm. Some good Get Out news in the past week.
Mm-hmm. A lot of Lady Bird.
Yeah, Lady Bird.
Willem Dafoe feels like nailed down.
Yes.
I think you wrote after the LAFCA awards came out that Willem Dafoe is maybe the only actual, like, clear, solid front runner. Like, I think
that and Coco.
Yeah, sure. Coco and animated. Pixar runs the table and animated again. But, like, in supporting actress, it feels like it's Allison Janney and Laurie Metcalf. And, you know, best actress, it feels like it's Saoirse.
I think Janney's falling off.
All right. Yeah.
Janney hasn't won. It's been Laurie Metcalf, and then Tiffany Haddish is the only thing that ruined. I mean, I'm really glad that Tiffany Haddish got that award from an august body. But that sort of broke Laurie Metcalf's streak. But otherwise, Laurie Metcalf is sort of the front runner. But she's not. It's not as cemented, I think, as Willem Dafoe. And there's just all these...
You know, in the opposite spirit of what you just did, which is generously tell me that I was right, I am going to gloat that I was right in a tweet thread with Richard about Laurie Metcalf versus Allison Janney, when everybody was saying that Allison Janney had it locked.
No.
And I was, like, squeaking, what about Laurie Metcalf? Mm-hmm. Anyway, now I'm...
No, you're right.
Grandly gloating.
Yeah, I'm not supposed to talk about the vote much, and I'll be kind of vague about it, but, you know, we voted for New York Film Critics Circle while I was on vacation last week, and I was, you know, in the room for those many hours that we were doing it, and Tiffany Haddish won, which was really exciting, and I think was partly the result of a sort of concerted pre-effort conspiracy between the younger members of the group to make that happen, and I'm really glad it did. But Metcalf was there, you know, close, and and Janney, I think, maybe kind of split the vote for her, and that's maybe why Haddish was able to win. But, like, there was just a marketable more of a presence for Metcalf than there was for Janney.
Yeah. And I think the movie has more traction. You know, Lady Bird has
people
more traction
love
than
I Tanya, but a lot of people hate it. So,
and the vast
no one hates
people,
Lady Bird.
Even people who are more lukewarm on Lady Bird, I think, you know, it's okay to say, Richard, you are more lukewarm on Lady Bird.
I just
Bird.
Don't think women should direct movies.
I know. It's, you know, you've made this very clear.
I think also Metcalf, like, lauded theater actress.
Yeah, she,
like,
just won a Tony.
Emmys galore, you know, whatever. Like, she, you know, and Janney's the same in a way, but I think Metcalf, for whatever reason, just has that kind of more of the imprimatur of, like, a, you know, a deserving win.
And I think that's the narrative around Willem Dafoe as well, is that, like, he's been nominated twice, he's never won. He's been in, I think it's like 80 plus movies. Julie did a great, you know, in conversation with him. Mm-hmm. Julie Miller did, that's on our website. You know, so just, like, when you look at Willem Dafoe, you're like, that guy doesn't have an Oscar. Like, I should have an Oscar. Yeah. Give it to him. You know, I mean, I like The Florida Project, but above and beyond that, I think even if voters don't watch The Florida Project, they would vote for Willem Dafoe on his, like, record alone. The question I have for you guys is what I feel like a trend in becoming part of this podcast, obsessively watching critics, you know, nominate or award things and trying to predict this. The supporting categories seem to be the ones that get firmed up early. This was the narrative around, like, Patricia Arquette,
Mahershala
J.K.
Ali.
Simmons, Mahershala Ali. Like, I don't know if you
Anne
guys...
Anne Hathaway.
I don't know if you guys have any thoughts about, like, why supporting seems to be the one that,
That's a good question.
Know, they can, like, drill down on.
Yeah, and it's especially surprising to me that Dafoe becomes that, because this has been all of these, like, beloved character actors. You've got Richard Jenkins in Shape of Water, which is a movie people clearly love. Michael Stuhlbarg in Call Me By Your Name. Like, all these people who have the same levels of affection, it seems. But somehow, Willem Dafoe has become... I think it helps that Willem Dafoe kind of stands for The Florida Project. And
I think that's
it worked,
exactly right.
And this was Mahershala Ali last year, too. I think everyone knew that he could be a win for Moonlight and was excited about that, not knowing that Moonlight would win Best Picture, because no one really expected that.
No, La La Land won.
Yeah, okay. Thank you, Faye Dunaway. So, like, honestly, sometimes I forget which one. Like, I get confused still. Anyway. So, yeah, I think everyone wants to, like, know that they're going to give Florida Project something. And Call Me By Your Name, I mean, we can talk about that. Timothée Chalamet has won 2 Best Actor prizes now. Like, that seems really much more of a threat.
I know.
It's
crazy.
So, yeah, the Dafoe can be, like, a clear stand-up for Florida Project, which is a movie clearly a lot of people love.
Yeah.
And I also think, you know, we talked on this podcast, or maybe I just had a conversation in my head, but like we've talked about Sam Rockwell's stock sort of going down as the Three Billboards stock generally goes down. And I think, you know, Richard and I were talking about this last night, the narrative around that character in that film, it like almost has less to do with his performance as it does people not wanting to award maybe a redeemed racist cop.
Yeah.
Versus Willem Dafoe, who's like, there's that scene, right, where he's protecting little girls from sexual predator. And, you know, that's like, that's a narrative we want to endorse. So, you know, it's, being part of this podcast really has made me realize like the larger narratives that have nothing to do with performance that really drive all of this.
Yeah. And I think Florida Project is a movie that people want to award. Maybe they feel a little skittish about giving it Best Picture because it's so small and it doesn't have any celebrities in it except for Willem Dafoe. You know, New York Film Critics Circle, Sean Baker won Best Director, which was kind of a surprise. But otherwise, like, I feel like, yeah, you're right, Katie, that like, as a neat representation of a movie that people love,
right,
an actor who's deserving has worked in 80 films or whatever. Like, there you go. That's kind of like, that's a no-brainer.
Yeah. You know? And I mean, I'm fine with it. I've been like stumping. I think it's supporting actor is a great category this year, but like, I don't think anyone's going to say Dafoe is not a deserving winner there.
And I think it's interesting you brought up Chalamet is that like, and I'm guilty of this as much as anyone else, like from Telluride on being like, oh, Gary Oldman, that's going to happen. Like it's time. And now it's like, Well, when does that start happening?
Yeah.
And it hasn't happened yet.
Yeah.
And I, you know, critics groups tend to kind of diverge from the Academy narrative on certain things. So it doesn't mean that like Oldman isn't a lock, you know, but it's interesting that that relentless march towards the podium in March hasn't started yet.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that might be another case where, as you say, Timothée Chalamet could stand for Call Me by Your Name if it doesn't land those larger awards.
Yeah.
Well, and I think, you know, it's almost the stakes are less high on supporting so that you can kind of like grab the top spot and hold it. Whereas with something like Gary Oldman, he might have just peaked too early, you know, and there's more of an effort by critics to say, wait a minute, like we're not just going to follow suit here. Like we're going to really put some thought into this. And is that really the best performance? Whereas maybe with supporting, I don't know. I mean, you could maybe Katie and Richard, you could shed light on voting processes with critics. But I wonder if there's a little bit more like, OK, we can check the box for supporting versus lead.
I think you're right. Yeah, the stakes are lower. It doesn't feel as charged. You can just kind of as comfortably be like, yeah, that's a nice little pat on the head award for you.
Yes.
Whereas we're gonna talk about the big guys later.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's worth noting like the remarkably different voting processes for all of these. Like the National Board of Review, they just submit ballots in separate rooms. New York Film Critics in L.A., you're all in the room. You were there together. You were like looking in the eye of the person who's voting for James Franco for The Disaster Artist, and you're like, well, if that person voted for him, maybe I should.
No. New York is anonymous.
Ballot.
It's written ballot.
But you can like see like what happens in the first round.
And you can tell who's voting for
him. And you can tell like when there's a wave of support in the first round and you vote again and you're like, okay, well, all these people are in for Tiffany Haddish. Maybe I can vote for Tiffany Haddish.
It makes such a difference to be in the room. Yeah.
And so, and then for the Critics' Choice Awards, you're just submitting your own ballot. So these nominations are just like representing a wide swath. And then you vote online. So I can see something like Gary Oldman winning with the Critics' Choice Awards because it's like everyone, there's not like that sense of a room swaying each other. And that's how the Oscars are voted on. That's how the SAG Awards. Like when you get into these larger voting bodies, I think some more of those like conventional narratives thing can start happening, which is what to me is interesting. When you get, you know, LAFCA and New York Film Critics, like they do really interesting things, and then maybe the rest of the season goes in a different direction. But I think it's interesting to like start with some like outliers and then maybe go more conventional.
It's in the nature of critics to overthink and to say, like, with all due respect, you know, and to say kind of like, wait a minute, I feel like we have a responsibility to elevate X, whereas I think it's in the nature of Academy voters to be like, no, that this is the one. And let's not forget that the largest group are actors, right?
Yeah.
So whereas, you know, I think they probably have a little bit more of a technical point of view on the performance or like an empathetic, like how hard was this performance, which I do think helps Gary Oldman, and a kind of like, man, if I were Gary Oldman, I'd sure want my career Oscar by then.
And a lot more people know him.
And they know.
Nobody knows Timothée Chalamet. Mm-hmm. He's 21 years old.
Yeah. Right.
You know.
And they probably like, envy and resent Timothée Chalamet.
Yeah.
Well, and you guys might know stats to back this up for me, but like I know that Timothée Chalamet is like one of the youngest.
Yeah, he'll be like the third youngest Best Actor nominee.
But there's
ever.
Definitely like a narrative, right, where young women can win a Best mm-hmm. Actress award, but young men don't often do that.
I still
right?
have a really yes. hard time seeing him winning Best Actor. Right. That just yeah. like, it could definitely happen. I mean, I think we've all learned that we can't predict these things as well as we might have thought we could. But it, I mean, you got Tom Hanks in there who won the NBR award, who's really great in The Post and like hasn't been nominated for Best Actor in like 16 years. You've got still got Gary Oldman. There's a lot of competition in there. James Franco's making a run at it. Like you can see Chalamet and Franco kind of like splitting the hip young vote. There's a lot of ways that could play out.
Well, and just the brutal rule of thumb still, despite all the efforts of the Academy, is that it's older men and they vote for the guy they want to be and the woman they want to sleep with. Like, you know, yeah. that's yeah. the rule of thumb. Until further notice, that's how no, this
I
works.
Mean, it's true. Well, you mentioned The Post and we can now talk about it. The embargo is
yeah.
up. And I think the thing about that movie, I don't think that Hanks is really the player there. I think Streep is.
No, I think yeah. Hanks could definitely get nominated, though.
Yeah, no, I think so, too. I mean, people like, although we've talked about Tom Hanks has had trouble getting nominated
getting
lately for Bridge of Spies and for Captain Phillips.
Yeah.
But The Post is actually really good. And I think that the combination of, you know, the way that we imagine Academy voters, who knows if this is actually true, but we've kind of crafted this narrative over the past 2 years of the stack of screeners on the coffee table. All right, time
light
to watch something.
Streaming through the window.
Lights, yeah, yeah, that just windows. Sunday afternoon, like slanted light of Los Angeles that I hate so much. You have, you know, some esoteric gay movie in Italy. You have a weird monster thing from the guy who's been kind of spotty. Or you have a Steven Spielberg movie with Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep. I think that's the one you're going to put in your DVD player yeah. and watch.
And I watched it on screener and didn't get to see it in theaters, and it plays really well on a screener.
Oh, well, yes. Yeah, and it's engaging, it's smart, it's well acted, it's timely. I think that even though that movie has had a little bit of trouble getting traction in these early critics things, I think part of that is just critics being like, nah, that's so expected. We want to be different, you know?
Yes.
Whereas, like you said, Mike, the Academy doesn't give a shit about that, really. I mean, they right. do time from here and there, but this is a big, solid Oscar movie that actually, in a weird way, I kind of argue in my review, it deserves that Oscar bait status, or yeah. it earns it.
Well, yeah. and so we talked about this last week, but I do think that, you know, the question will end up being, are Academy voters more upset about Trump and want to stand up with the press against Trump? Or are they upset that their industry is being ripped apart by sexual harassment articles?
Right, right.
And are they resenting the press?
The literal sex,
you know what
monster.
I mean? And by the way, it's easy to then kind of say, and look at the press, too, is also being ripped apart by sexual. You're a bunch of hypocrites.
Yeah.
And you know what I mean? So I just don't know, like, how toxic...
But
which toxic situation is going to yeah. win?
But what the Post has in its favor is that it is a story about the press going up against a autocratic presidential administration, but it's also about women in the workplace.
Yeah. It's also about a feminist, you know, story
in
a sense.
So yeah. having those two kind of things dovetail is I think makes it pretty strong.
And yeah, I mean, I think you put it out in your review that, like, even if you like went and being like, oh God, Meryl Streep again, like Meryl Streep has made fun of this idea that like she just wins everything, and then she's really good in it. Like she gives this great. Like level of performance that you're like, oh yeah, that's what she can do.
I'm still planting my flag on Saoirse. Saoirse is my horse in this race.
I mean, I think it's an interesting competition between the two of them, because I think we all thought Saoirse was like so much of a dark horse that we wanted to root for, and then she's winning critics prizes. And
no, if Laurie Metcalf wins Best Supporting, then maybe they won't give it to both women from Lady Bird.
Yeah, it's hard to kind of game that out, because when people are filling out their winners, like they are by themselves filling out their ballot, like it's hard to kind of think along those lines.
I like the idea of us moving towards a world, and maybe this has been historically true, where each category just represents, and especially this year when we can't like decide what the film is, each category represents like, oh, here's the Florida Project,
mm-hmm.
here's Call Me By Your Name, here's Lady Bird. Like they all get a big award if it's not the big award.
Well, it still mm-hmm. feels like a very open race with a lot of contenders compared to previous years, mm-hmm. right? I mean, for the Shape of Water to bounce back today, to me, is surprising.
I'm yeah.
like, wow, we're going to keep yeah. that in mind too.
Yeah.
No, and by the way, this is Dunkirk still rolling
still
and Get Out is still rolling.
I was about to say, we haven't talked about Get Out yet, which made yeah. like it made like the Caillou de Cinema and Sight and Sound poll of like the 10 best films in the world, which, you know, those are like super, super snobby list. And the fact
yes.
that Get Out is on there, that's interesting.
Yeah.
If the mm-hmm. French like you, I mean, yeah.
I know.
Yeah. No, I think Get Out, I think just yesterday kind of surged to the top of the Gold Derby screenplay odds
mm-hmm.
or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's its best shot.
You know, I think Jordan Peele's definitely getting a Best Director nomination at this point.
Yeah, yeah, so cool. And that one also, you know, is it like The Post? It has dual benefits, which is one, it's really well made, and two, it has this political tenor to it. So so that maybe that's the strategy this year, and that's where I feel like possibly, you know, something like Shape of Water, which does have a political element to it, sort of. Maybe suffers because it doesn't quite feel as timely, and maybe timely is what we're kind of after. I don't know.
Yeah.
The Shape of Water win that made me really sit up and pay attention was for the LAFCA over the weekend. They gave it Best Cinematography over, and Roger Deakins was the runner up for Blade Runner. And
yeah.
Like, I know that Blade Runner has sort of fallen out of the conversation, but there was this whole thing of like, this is Roger Deakins' year again, finally. And then I was like, Shape of Water won over, and like they named Deakins as a runner up, and then like, you know, won Best Picture, Sally Hawkins, Best Director, like LAFCA just gave it all to Shape of Water. It was crazy. So
if Roger Deakins doesn't win, I'm gonna feel sad.
Well, at New York Film Critics, the cinematographer for Mudbound won.
Yeah,
and she was the first woman to ever win.
Although that, and like, you don't have to like give secrets from in the room, that did feel like sticking a finger in the eye of Netflix to give the cinematography award to a film that most people will view on Netflix, because Netflix put Mudbound in like 15 theaters and was like, this is great. We've done our job.
No comment.
I mean, Mudbound is like, it's got some Critics' Choice Awards nominations. Like, I don't, like, it's hard. I mean, it would be amazing if Dee Reese could get a Best Director nomination. When you have, like, you know, Greta Gerwig's in the running, having two women nominated for Best Director, that'd be amazing. I mean, it still feels to me like you've got The Post and Dunkirk are kind of like standing as the studio-y movies, and you've got Lady Bird and The Florida Project and Call Me By Your Name and Get Out and kind of this like critical darling pack. I have a hard time seeing, maybe Get Out could break out from that, but the others, like, they all seem kind of like they're consuming each other. In a way.
Right.
And you didn't even mention Shape of Water.
Yeah, Shape of Water, I think, is kind of on its own because it's got all this technical stuff to it. Like,
right,
you can see
okay.
Shape of Water, like, leading, I think, either Shape of Water or Dunkirk winds up getting the most nominations because they've got all the technical categories. They got, like, editing and visual effects and stuff like that. So, like, that gives it an edge in a different way where, like, more people are going to be considering it from different angles.
Yeah. So what's so fun about this podcast is, like, we were talking this summer, we're like, oh, nothing's going to touch Dunkirk.
I know.
It's going.
I know.
And now The Post has sort of swallowed up its like prestige Best Picture area, and Shape of Water is encroaching on its technical awards. So what if Dunkirk just walks away with nothing?
There's another movie that we can now talk about because the embargo's up the morning this is going to be posted, is Phantom Thread, the Paul Thomas Anderson movie, which has won a couple things here and there. New York Film Critics gave it Best Screenplay. Leslie Manville is very much now in the kind of supporting actress hunt, even if, you know, she's probably not going to win, but she could get nominated. And that's another really great movie. And it's also something of a bounce back for Paul Thomas Anderson, who has made previous two kind of impenetrable, esoteric movies in The Master and Inherent Vice. And this could maybe be his, you know, re-entry into the sort of awards conversation since, you know, 10 years after There Will Be Blood and deserving. And Daniel Day-Lewis, you know, talking about Meryl Streep arriving with a late in the season spoiler, Daniel Day-Lewis is in supposedly his last movie, is great in it.
Well, so. I'm going to say that I thought that this was impenetrable and esoteric.
Oh, okay.
I also love The Master, so who knows?
I also love The Master.
You can't argue about taste, but I don't know. This movie is very weird. I'm sure that Daniel Day-Lewis will be nominated, but I didn't get it.
Well, so I think, you know, the screening I went to was at the Directors Guild Theater on 57th Street in Manhattan, and so it was kind of a sort of in the know crowd. On a Sunday evening post Thanksgiving, and there was a Q&A with Anderson and Daniel Day-Lewis and Leslie Manville and Vicky Creeps, best name of the year, by the way, Vicky Creeps.
Doesn't she look like a young Meryl Streep? It's kind
she
of
she kind of does.
Really
looks
like a gummer.
Yeah. She's got a gummer gummer quality about her. Paul Thomas Anderson told a story about the origin of the movie, which was that he was really sick, without spoiling anything, but like he was really sick, and Maya Rudolph, his wife, was just like really kind to him and just like taking care of him. And then the next day he was feeling better, and all of a sudden they were kind of like in a fight.
Yeah.
And he was like, he's like, I have an idea for a movie called Day-Lewis, and was like, let's do this. So I think that in that movie, if I were Maya Rudolph and I watched that movie, which is kind of this weird, twisted romantic comedy kind of in the end, I would feel really like happy and sort of seen and like be like, oh, we are, you know, we may fight, we may have a weird marriage, but like in the end it works despite itself. In the same way that if I were Rachel Weisz or Jennifer Lawrence and watched Mother, I'd be like, holy shit, like this is horrible. Like both are kind of male auteurs making movies about how they interact with women in their lives.
But you thought that it was I thought it was like a horrifying self-portrait. If it's a self-portrait, I found it deeply disturbing. And I was like not in the mood to laugh at the quirks of like a misanthropic, mean, misogynistic man.
But personally, sweet in the end, because like I feel like they find a place of parody. And I feel like that Vicky Creeps' character has agency. And in the end, he sort of agrees to her stuff as much as she agrees to his.
It sounds like Secretary.
Yeah, maybe it is a little like Secretary. Yeah.
I haven't seen it yet, but my thought watching the trailer, and I like, you know, I liked The Master and other things, but is that it reads as chilly. Does it feel chilly watching the whole thing?
At times in the beginning, and then I think it just warms as it goes. I think it's, I was really taken by it.
We were talking about, I think, when Carol came out, like one of the reasons maybe that Carol didn't penetrate in the award season was a chilliness about it, that's like a hard thing to get around, that the post is like inspiring this warmth and the Phantom Thread might not.
Yeah, I don't think that Phantom Thread is a contender in like best picture maybe, but I think on a screenplay or cinematography or maybe an acting thing here or there.
So are we underestimating Daniel Day-Lewis as a threat to just kind of sweep in and win his third
Oscar? I think the one thing about his chances for this movie, while he's wonderful in it, it's one of his quieter roles. You know, the past two times he's won, it's been Daniel Plainview, who was this like avatar of American, you know, rapacious greed or whatever. We have Lincoln, who's
who?
Lincoln.
Yeah.
He played Lincoln Chafee, the former presidential candidate. It's a really interesting movie. This is not those two things. I mean, so I think that I feel like this would be like the sort of respectful nod. Like he'll get the nomination. I'll be like, you know, if this is you going out, you went out well.
Yeah,
sir,
you don't nominate Daniel Day-Lewis if he says he's going to quit acting.
Right.
But I do think people might resent the whole like I'm going to quit acting thing, either to be like, what do you mean you're going to quit acting? Right. Like who? I don't know. Like
you don't walk away from us.
Yeah. A, that, and B, I think people are. I'm always worried. It's like a bit of a stunt. You know what I mean?
It doesn't feel like a like. I don't think he's a stunt kind of guy.
It's not a stunt.
It just feels like, why announce it? Like Soderbergh too. It's just like, why say it when like. I don't care that it's not sticking, but like, just don't say it in the first place. Yeah.
My feeling is it's going to be really great and also kind of annoying when he does another movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like it was when Cher would go back on tour.
Right.
You know?
I mean, speaking of stunts, the fact that it looks like James Franco is going to get an Oscar nomination, like that still kind of blows my mind, given that he like ruined the Oscars single-handedly. Like, if I were them, I might have trouble forgiving him for it. But he keeps winning critics prizes or getting nominated. And I think he's really great in The Disaster.
He's great. It's a really good movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's campaigning. I mean, like, this is something we need to, we will talk about, but like the actors who campaign versus the ones who don't. Like, we were talking last night, Richard, about Frances McDormand is not an actress who's going to campaign.
Yeah.
So as much as her, like, chances seem to be taking a hit, she's not going to do anything to go out there and, like, turn that narrative around.
Yeah.
That's just not who she is. Daniel Day-Lewis has never campaigned a day in his life, probably.
Right. So, whereas Saoirse Ronan just hosted SNL.
Exactly.
And, you know, she's on the beat.
And I think Gary Oldman also famously like doesn't really want anything to do with the process. I think it seemed clear that he was going to be campaigning more this year as part of this, but, you know, that hasn't, like, that part of the circuit hasn't really started yet.
Well, we saw Gary Oldman at TIFF. He went and dutifully did the red carpet.
Yeah.
He was mildly charming.
Yeah.
And I remember for, during Lincoln, you know, I remember like Daniel Day-Lewis would like show up to the Critics Awards, you know, the Gotham Awards or whatever it was, and give a little speech. Like, it's not like, but they're not gonna do the full
right.
They're not gonna show up to the opening of an envelope.
Right. They're not gonna follow the Peggy Siegel drum march.
Yeah,
or
no,
drum beat.
Right,
rather.
Exactly. Right. And lunch with every single Academy member that they
that
dig
seems
up.
Seems unlikely.
Yeah. But no, Saoirse Ronan, who is like willing to do that and is young and like probably has more energy for all of it. Like, she is incredibly charming, and she'll show up at the New York Film Critics Circle Awards, give a really charming speech, just like she did last year for Brooklyn. And like that year she wasn't really a front runner, but this year it kind of feels like that could make her one.
I would love to think that the female directors this year have an edge, because Dee Reese and Greta Gerwig are both incredibly charming, wonderful people to hang out with and talk to.
This year's director crowd, like, I'm looking at Gold Derby right now, you've got like Guillermo del Toro, who can tell the hell out of a story. You've got Christopher Nolan, who has this kind of like chilly English charm to him. Like, I think everyone likes to be around him. Luca Guadagnino tells a good anecdote. Like, there's a lot of good people. Steven Spielberg's in there.
And you've got two actors. You've got Jordan Peele and Greta Gerwig.
Yeah.
Who can just perform in that role, you know what I mean?
Yeah, so. That seems like a good segue to talk about our awards issue that's out this week.
Let's do it.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness, really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah. Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Jordan Peele and Greta Gerwig are on the cover of this award special. It's not going to be in mailboxes. Like, you only get it if you're an Academy voter, right, Mike?
That's right. An Academy voter or a member of one of the big guilds.
Yeah. But all of the stories are online. They're all going, yes, including the photo shoot of Jordan Peele and Greta Gerwig and the cover story that Rebecca
They're wonderful
wrote.
Photos.
Gorgeous.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Those photos. Yeah.
The cover is really great. And yeah. Hillary Fitzgibbons did the lettering herself, which she was the designer of the whole issue. She's awesome.
Which kind of reminded me of the Lady Bird credits. Like, remember how there's like those very carefully hand lettered credits.
Yes.
And Call Me By Your Name. Like, they're very, it's a good time for hand lettering.
Well, you know, and I want to say something cool that happened, if I can, when we were, I think I'm allowed to say this, when we were trying to figure out which image to put on the cover, there were a few more conventional options. And Graydon was looking at them and he was like, we don't have to sell this on newsstands, right? And we said, no. And he said, let's pick this one. Like, if you have an opportunity to do something cool, do something different,
yeah,
let's do something different. And so then that's when we had the idea to add the lettering to it. So I'm really proud of the whole team that put it together. Nicole Sperling has a big story that's been online for a couple weeks now about the Netflix war. But anyone who listens to this podcast, I think, would be interested in reading that story if you haven't already, about the war between the traditional theatrical distributors and studios and Netflix, and how they're kind of using the Oscar as a cudgel to fight. And then Katie, your piece just went up yesterday about Harvey Weinstein and how that's changing award season. And Richard's got great previews of everything. And Joanna, meanwhile, is not in this issue only because she wrote the dang cover story for the what is it? The holiday issue, we call it.
And what is this little Marvel indie studio, Marvel?
Yeah, Marvel.
Tell me about it.
It's like an A24 kind of thing.
Like a scrappy little startup. Yeah, no, I got to write about the last 10 years of Marvel Studios. I was trying to figure out, like, how do I make this relevant to an award season podcast? And I will share this anecdote. When I was asking I talked to Kevin Feige, the head of Marvel Studios, about sort of this unprecedented success that they've had and building this franchise where all these other studios are floundering trying to do so. And I asked him about Rotten Tomatoes, because this is something that, like, the rival DC franchise is like, down with Rotten Tomatoes. They're ruining movies.
And their fans are obsessed with it.
Yeah. And I was like, do you care about Rotten Tomatoes? And he was like, we love Rotten Tomatoes. Obviously, they get good scores. But he was like, he's like, we're not going to win any awards ever for anything. But they send us over these little Lucite fresh placards when you get a movie that's fresh. Like, Rotten Tomatoes sends you a little placard that says your movie was rated fresh on our website. He's like, we have them all lined up. I demand to see them as soon as they come in. He's like, I care a lot about them. They're the only awards we're ever going to win. I was like, okay.
That's fascinating, actually. I didn't know they did that.
That and the stacks of $100 bills.
Sure. But he also, you know, he also was like, in that, like, question that we're grappling with of, like, what the audience, the fans love and what the critics love and are they the same? He's like, I think they're just generally the same. Like, people like good movies. And he's like, sometimes they don't agree, but for the most part, you know, like, it aligns.
I think so. The somewhat tepid box office for Justice League would kind of bear that out, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you know, people are fine, like, enough. Like, we're not, we don't care.
Yeah, but they're doing this insane two-part Avengers movies thing where, you know, we did this great photo shoot in Atlanta where just,
you got,
like,
so many people for
it's
it.
It's unbelievable crazy. How many stars that they have in these films. It's crazy.
And it's interesting because they are sort of now at this fulcrum crux point where, you know, the sort of older members of this Avengers team are sort of, their contracts are up and their narrative is maybe coming to an end. And so the piece is a really good reflection back, but also looking forward. And I think, you know, like it or not, the Marvel film industry is a huge part of the economy of what we talk about. So yes. So it's you know, it's crucial, I think, if you want to pay attention to how things are working, to know about what they're doing. And so I think that it was good that you were able to shine a light on it.
Thanks, Richard.
I think my favorite subplot of the entire story, and you know, we talked about while you were writing it, is just my mental image of you sitting in Kevin Feige's office and asking him a direct question and him just like staring back at you being like, I'm not telling you anything. Like, my brain is a locked box. And
like, you can like practically, he's so nice and he's very smart, obviously, but like you can just see the wheels going and he's like, how do I carefully word this answer?
Yeah, because he has like, he has the next 20 movies in his head. Yeah. Like, there's so many things he could say that could like...
And I'm like, give me anything? And he's like, no.
Like, he could tip you off on the plot of like Ant-Man 4 and like, yeah, that he knows what it's going to be and it's coming out in 15 years.
But he'll just like smile so genially at you while he does it. He's just like, he looks like everyone's dad. He's wearing like a ball cap and jeans.
Yeah.
And like, he's just like, no.
You got any Robert Downey Jr. stories?
Robert Downey Jr. Yes. Robert Downey Jr. I was talking about this last night. He and a few other people who have interviewed him corroborated this for me. First of all, he likes to keep the set at 68 degrees at all times. They call it the meat locker. So on every set that he's on, it's at 68 degrees and they're all freezing. And he's, when he's speaking to you, it's captivating. He spoke to me twice. They're like, he likes to get warmed up. So he's going to speak to you for 15 minutes and then he's going to go away. And then you're going to go talk to him later for much longer. It's like, okay. And he did that, also happened. And he was lovely.
We should do our podcast that way. We should do 15 minutes of banter and warm up.
Go to the cafeteria.
Where did he go in the interim?
He filmed some of this movie.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay.
He just like go in a closet or something like that. Right. But he
put on the Iron Man suit.
He's like super, so engaging. And like everything is coming out of his mouth is just like, you know, beautifully worded poetry. And I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. And I wrote it all down. And I submitted like the quotes to my lovely editor, Stephanie Mehta. And she was like, these don't make any sense of content. And I was like, no, they do. She's like, no, just read them and pretend you weren't there basking in his presence. And I was like, oh yeah, okay. So like, you need the performance from Robert to like sell the words that he's using. And it like matters and makes sense in the moment. He also had put together a Fiesta Friday celebration for his teammates. He's like, oh, there's a mariachi band here. And someone was like, Robert hired a mariachi band. He's like, I didn't hire a mariachi band. I just said offhand, it would be nice to have a mariachi band. And like, I'm like, you know that whatever you say offhand, it would be nice to have.
Yeah, there are like four people on set to like make sure that happens.
Marvel once, I don't know if this is, it's a common story, known story, that Marvel once shipped all of Robert Downey Jr.'s furniture from his LA house to his house on the East Coast so that when he was filming, he could just like furnish that house that he was living in with his LA furniture.
See, that's the type of support that I would like to have.
Yeah, sure.
Here.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
we
you really
need to work on
you really need to get
it would be nice if people would buy me multiple residences and move my furniture.
It would be nice if we had a mariachi band here today. That's all.
Well, okay, so your Marvel story and a lot of extra stuff, including your extended interview with Kevin Feige and a whole piece about Marvel is a very suddenly controversial piece about Marvel movies being the best television series that I'm sure is going to make a lot of TV critics very happy.
Yeah, they love it.
It's they are all online right now, as are all of the many of the awards extra stories are all going on. So,
oh, and I should mention the Jordan Peele video that really took off on YouTube. It's really fun. It's like 9 minutes of him just reading fan theories about Get Out and basically fact checking them.
Yeah.
So if you do nothing else, please watch that video.
That does it for this week's Liberal Gold Men. Thank you for listening. Find us on Apple Podcasts where you can rate and review the show and share it with people. It is the time of year to do that. We are all at vanityfair.com where you can find so many of the stories that we just talked about and more writing about award season. And we're all on Twitter at Liberal Gold Men and on our own. I'm at Katie Rich. Richard?
Rylaws.
Joanna.
Joe wrote this.
And Mike?
Mike Hogan with a little underscore line in the middle.
Your existential struggle with this underscore.
I know, you're crazy.
It's the best sub-narrative of this podcast.
You can change your Twitter handle.
No, I already did change it.
Yeah,
I had an even worse one
it.
Before.
It was worse.
But there's so many Mike Hogan's. It's like, you know.
What about like, we can figure something out.
Okay.
Let's workshop this. Listeners,
Please, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts about
Mike's
what
new
Mike's,
Twitter
Mike's new Twitter handle should be.
This episode was edited and produced by Jordan Bell, and thanks to Andy Bowers at Panoply. And this week's award for a preview of Mike's response to your suggestions for his new Twitter handle goes to Mike Hogan.
I didn't get it.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.